Okay, yes. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic. I've been running a marathon. Paul has been fitting in water pumps for charity in Colombia or somewhere. And our guest, Helen, has been running a marathon but with a broken leg. And hello, 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 and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. Cheers, everybody. Cheers, Paul. Cheers, Helen. Cheers, Robert Christian 653. Come on, Eileen, he says. Cheers, shows Bism 4440. Hurligan Gurligan, K Piss.
Scrub your nan, Yaki Dart.
Frost, a skull, what else?
Chaim.
Turby Sexy, and what's the Polish thing? Nazrovia.
Nazrovia.
Yes, indeed. And Slanger and Slangervar. And welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic. We are, of course, online public house. It's on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, which discuss based science and psychology and stuff in the news and things that are increasingly expunged from our woke joke universities. And by the way, this is a public house where you are allowed to vertically drink. And we'll be talking about that later. That's a new attack on the British pub. They've got rid of smoking. They've got rid of having fun. They've got rid of talking. And soon it's going to be no standing and drinking, apparently. So cheers, Proust, Proust, Benson, Proust. And yes, hello and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. I don't know where Lipton is. I don't know what he's playing at. So we'll just start without him. Okay. Now, we have a special guest for you today. And that is Helen Dale. So I ask Helen to introduce yourself.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't normally sort of talk about this kind of topic, but I wrote a Substack that was very popular about it. Because one aspect, and it is a very particular aspect of this whole issue, annoys me enormously, which is when people are accused of being racists when they're not. So I'll park that for a minute. But by way of background, I'm a retired solicitor, although I did spend some time in Australia as a barrister. So in the United States, I think you would just say trial attorney, I would think, for that. And I still do some legal work. I do some consulting. And I also do legal writing for Law and Liberty, the magazine, which is owned by Liberty Fund. So I mainly do legal commentary, and quite a bit of the Substack piece that I wrote on this was mainly to get straight for people exactly what the involvement of Carter Ruck, who are a leading United Kingdom defamation firm, are actually doing in the Arday affair, and explaining why, for example, just basic legal stuff that most people won't know, why, for example, Nathan Kofta's got to break the story and not Jack Grove from the Times Higher Education Supplement. And the particular little the thing that really annoys me, which was one section of the Substack that I wrote, is over the accusation, people being accused of racism when they're not racists. And that, of course, has been levelled quite regularly over the last fortnight at Nathan Koffness. So I wanted to tell that story completely straight. And I have personal reason for that is because I've had it done to me, admittedly a very, very long time ago now. And it wasn't fatal the way it has been during the period of peak woke, since, particularly since, say, about 2014 or 15, based on Jonathan Haidt's research. So,
I mean, their argument about Nathan Koffness is he has written an academic paper which defends inquiries into group differences, and therefore he's a racist. That's it.
The other thing that they're using against him is the quotation, and it is a quotation that if you had admitted to US universities, and I talk a little bit about this in my piece, the way admissions to Australian universities were done until I think about 2005, and it may have even been later, where there was no affirmative action at all and there is no personal statement. It's purely based on results. The reference is the expression used in Australia is cutoffs. If you had that in the United States, it would mean that approximately 0.7% of the people admitted to Harvard University, and he uses them as his model because all the data is public because of the Students for Fair Admission litigation, would be African-American. And the thing is, even that tiny group, there's no guarantee that they'll be African-American descendants of slaves. They're quite likely to be posh Nigerians. So So that, and that is a direct quotation from Harvard University. And Nathan Koftos gets accused of racism for quoting it. And I just find that absolutely infuriating.
Apparently there's an echo on my audio. Yeah, there is. Is this you, Lipton? Is it your end?
No, it's not me. Hello, Ellen.
Lipton, turn your sound off.
Let me turn it. Okay.
Okay. Because the drink... If you turn the sound off, you haven't turned it off yet.
Yeah, I'm up now.
No, you haven't
turned
it off.
Yeah, so I don't know how many of you know this, but Ellen Dale likes my tweets sometimes on my articles.
Oh, I don't see. Are you Lipton Matthews on Twitter?
Yes.
Though? See, this is the thing. See, this is the problem. I was because I unfortunately don't recognise your name, but I just might see something interesting, and so I like it.
She's always liking my stuff.
Because the other thing that I have done, just as a sideline, most of my life I've been a lawyer, but the sideline thing that I've done is I've had three novels published, and they've done pretty well. And the first one was an enormous bestseller, and it was the first one, and I will do the duty here.
Why is there this echo?
Am I echoing?
No, I don't know if it's me. I'll go out and come back.
Yes, you are echoing. I can hear you now. It's really notable.
How are you doing, Lipton?
Well, I'm good. I don't know who you're going to take this, Paul. But today, you're not the smartest guest on the show or the smartest co-host.
Oh, you just like to hedge your bets, Lipton.
I'm going to talk now, see if I echo. No.
Test.
No, it's all right.
Oh, I'm echoing now.
Oh, God. And this is, they get very upset. They get very, 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 very autistic about any kind of noise. And they write echo in capital letters in the chat to really, really annoy me. But apparently I'm not echoing. So we're all right. So, yes, Helen, you're going to show your novel to people. Which one's that? That was the one that got me accused of racism. Yeah, have you got earphones or something? Maybe that's what it is. Have you got earphones? You're wearing earphones. This is really weird because you're now echoing. It's just a Zoom background. Oh, for God's sake. Oh, sorry, we're going to have to sort this out or we can't continue with the show. Who is echoing now, chat? Okay? Because remember, I don't want nonsense.
Am I echoing?
Yeah, I definitely am.
All right, I'll try taking Helen out and putting her back in again. Oh, this is fucking ridiculous. I think the variable seems to be Lipton. I'm going to remove Lipton. Right. Okay. What's going on now? No echo.
Oh, I'll speak.
And there's no echo off me, is there?
Either.
It's Lipton. He's a poltergeist.
Lipton, it's something at your end. Can you please sort it out and switch them? I'll switch your microphone off. I don't know what to do about this.
If you're a betting person, what were the odds it was going to be Lipton?
The odds were extremely high. It has to be conceded that the odds were very high that if anybody was going to have an echo problem, it was Lipton. Right, Lipton, you're going to have to wear earphones or something. I'm putting you back in. I'm going to switch off your mic. Oh, there you go. Straight away.
Lipton, could you put the lid down on your piano? That might help.
Let me see. I'm not echoing.
Test?
I'm going to have to turn his mic off. Mute. Right. Okay. Now it's okay. So Lipton, if you want to speak, you're going to have to raise your hand so I can see. Okay. Got that? Yep. Okay. Good. All right. So we've now completely lost the topic. Where were we? Right. Yeah. Helen. Yeah. So.
Oh, I just finished my introduction, and then we had some tech chat, and.
We've got over the tech chat. So law wise, it's very suspicious, isn't it? That he apparently didn't report a masked man breaking into his department and threatening to kill him.
Well, there's a whole variety of legal issues. I can discuss some of them, but I don't know how you do this, but you can put my piece in the show notes where I go through the legal stuff with Carter Ruck. You've had this thing of complaints to the police that don't seem to have happened. There isn't a crime reference number, so on and so forth. Although we have had problems recently where the police in across the United Kingdom, but in particularly in the Met and parts of England and Wales, where the police have been behaved egregiously. They really have. So you do wonder what's going on sometimes with them. The material with Carter Ruck is actually more serious. For I don't know how many American listeners you have, libel, what you call defamation in your country, which is quite unusual. Normally it's Roman law countries that call it that. They deal, libel laws work very differently in Britain from the way they work in the United States, because we don't have a judgment like New York Times and Sullivan, which means public figures have to make out act malice. You don't have to do that. Whereas in the United Kingdom, the onus is reversed, and it means the person who's made the claim then has to prove on the civil standard of proof, on the balance of probabilities, that is, that it's true. Now, there's some complexity here in the background, in that historically British newspapers have tended to behave very badly, the famous Red Tops and News of the World and so on and so forth. But even by the standards of that, engaging Carter Ruck is both a very aggressive proposition and a very expensive one. The running joke that when I was in practice was always that the people at Carter Ruck didn't get out of bed in the morning for less than £10,000. You know, and that would be literally review the documents and write and draft a concerns notice, which is the first stage in the defamation proceeding, which it doesn't seem to have gone any further than the concerns notice at this point. Or it may have even been a preliminary document before the concerns notice, but I suspect it did get to the concerns notice stage. And what is interesting about this is, because of the expense of engaging that firm, it's not clear who did, who instructed Carter Ruck and then who retained them on an ongoing basis, because this is a story that has happened in stages. It was first there was John Harris, and then there was quite a gap, and there was another chap who had a minor involvement in the middle in terms of knowing material about what had happened with Jason Arday. And then there was Jack Grove from a legitimate and well-regarded publication in the UK called the Times Higher Ed Supplement, which is kind of an adjunct to the Times newspaper and is ultimately owned by Rupert Murdoch. Now, one of the things that large print organisations and Rupert Murdoch's News Limited is no exception to this do, is they pay very significant premiums for libel insurance or slander insurance, defamation insurance, to cover them if they lose in court, particularly if the litigation involves someone like Carter Ruck. So I am still somewhat puzzled as to why the newspaper backed down. I can understand the retired academic, okay, and just backing right away from it, because the thing is, if you lose a defamation lawsuit and you aren't a man of straw, and the retired academic may not be a man of straw, he may have a lovely house in Plymouth, he has got a lifetime of professional achievement, and it's not in his wife's name. That's the traditional classic way of making yourself writ proof. Or it's not in a trust. In some ways, you know, separation between the person and ownership in some way, shape or form. And so I'm puzzled as to why News Limited, Murdoch's outfit, backed down in response. And my suspicion that I cannot prove, which is why I am going to say it's only a suspicion and say it's an opinion rather than an assertion of fact, is that I don't think Jason Arday engaged or instructed Carter Ruck. I think Cambridge University did. And
where would he get the money even though it's about $100,000 or whatever you might own as a professor of sociology of education at Cambridge, I don't know how much it's, something like that. It's still, they would have a substantial layout.
Yes, it's, I mean, you just need to have, to start with, you would need, for very, very basic things, you would need thousands of pounds, probably, and the figure that is always plucked out of the air is you would need £10,000 just sitting in a bank account somewhere to flick to the law firm. And then because you've engaged them on a particular matter, you then have to keep paying them. Now, there's no, as lawyers are always saying, there's no such thing as a general retainer. So you don't have a law firm that you just get to deal with all your legal matters. But in a specific defined area, you then pay a retainer, and in this case, it's a defamation matter, and you keep that firm, and they are the person, the outfit that you instruct when, as and when you need them, but on that defined matter.
Why do you think, and I open this up to Paul and Lipton as well, if Lipton can deal with his sound, why do we think, I mean, is it that there was some, why did it happen at this stage? I mean, Nathan apparently was approached by various people and asked about this, and he surely took a rather substantial risk considering he lives.
Well, the thing is, this is defamation. The retired academic in Plymouth is not a, to use the lawyer's expression, is not a man of straw. He has assets. Nathan is a young junior academic. He doesn't have money. There is no reason to bring defamation. There is no value in bringing defamation litigation against a man of straw. It's a very, very good strategy to use. You know, someone who can't be sued because he doesn't have any money. So you, the expression that you sometimes hear lawyers use is, well, you can't get blood from a stone.
But Helen, why didn't they then, the Times Higher, stick up for themselves? Because that argument doesn't apply to them.
I don't know. I am puzzled because they have litigation relevant insurance.
If a major newspaper can't defend itself on a legitimate story, it doesn't deserve to be in business.
And this is why there are things about this story. I wanted this to have come out by today, and Ed is quite correct. There has been an enormous amount come out, and it's entirely possible that the full story on this aspect will appear tomorrow. But by the same token, lawyers are very good at playing their cards close to their chest. And so we may not find out about it, particularly if it is the university, if it is Cambridge University that instructed Carter Ruck and not Jason Arday. And I think that that is what has probably happened. And they'll play their cards close to their chest. You're going to need a male inside, and you won't get one in the law firm. You're going to need somebody on the inside of the university who's willing to blow the whistle, because this is very irregular. I have dealt with litigation in this area in the past, and it is very irregular, and I don't know what's going on. I wrote a significant part of the Substack piece that I wrote on this, is I think that there are very, very serious problems with parts of the academy, like very serious problems. And I'm not just talking the obvious things that you people talk about with in terms of wokery and telling lies about, you know, giving people false information about average differences between groups and that kind of thing. I'm talking about there is like extraordinary structural corruption and, you know, entire disciplines that are essentially valueless.
Well, worse than that, Helen, within disciplines, well-established disciplines, I was in a scenario before I left where I wouldn't accept overseas master's students who they'd finagled it so that they were somehow enabled to take undergraduate final year courses to give them extra options. And I refused them, and I got into a bit of aggro over it until I hit upon the argument I wouldn't take them was they couldn't handle the course material. And ironically, that met with no resistance because they knew I was being honest. So you're in a Kafkaesque situation where master's level teaching at a Russell Group university is patently below undergraduate level. In what world does that make sense? And the reason is they lower standards to get international currency,
students,
which is a scam.
It has become quite clear that across a number of dimensions, higher education is essentially a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
I mean, Kemi Badenoch talked about the mad system of student loans and how that is, but it's also the funneling people into the classic Ponzi structure of funneling people into the bottom so that the people at the top benefit. It's really not good. And in many respects, because so many people have written about this and because this has caused so many academics to break cover about the mad stuff that's going on, people are getting a bit of a glimpse of just how rotten aspects of higher education actually are.
But Helen, it goes even more structurally to the country as a whole, because I've long argued this. One of the reasons it won't change in the foreseeable future is most northern English industrial cities, the multiplier economic effect of having big universities and a number of colleges, since we've largely deindustrialized, most northern cities couldn't survive without their universities' contribution to their local economy.
I know. The whole thing is just extraordinary, and I don't know how you fix it.
Lipton, you want to say something?
Yes.
Are the echoes back?
Is Nathan Kofnas being sued?
No.
Okay. Because you're talking.
Are you going to sue him, Lipton?
In Cambridge. So I arrived late, so I didn't get that context.
No, he's not been sued. Did you not ask him about this when you interviewed him?
About him being sued? No, that did not come up because I wasn't privy to such information.
Jason Ardaie is being sued because he seems to have plagiarized this doctoral thesis by this reader in.
But he also threatens to be sued by his own students because.
Yes, I think it's much more likely in terms of a legally productive case. In order for the doctoral student to plagiarise, the amount of plagiarism would need to, for it to be legally significant rather than just academically significant, it would need to reach, generally, it needs to reach approximately 10% of the source material. And then the claim is that is brought, but it's a civil claim, it's not a criminal matter, it's a civil claim would need to be brought by the person whose work has been copied. And then it's a claim for breach of copyright.
Yeah, but Helen, what about the actual students who've been taught by a fraudster?
This is where I think it may well be more productive legal opportunities for those students. It would depend, for example, on the relationship between when a student is admitted to a university is a contractual one. So it would depend on the terms of the contract that they entered into. But it would not surprise me, although I would need to see the document, if there are undertakings from British universities to teach students to a certain standard, a certain number of hours a week, to provide materials for them and so on and so forth. Now, we've all heard horror stories about terrible, terrible lecturers at universities. So this really probably does need to be a pretty high bar. But someone just sitting cross-legged in front of the class on a desk and not using his slide deck and not talking about what's supposed to be the course material and
yeah, but Helen, it's not about the it's not about the quality of the teaching. It's about the qualifications to teach. So, for example, you could be a bad gas installer, but you still have to be Corgi registered. You still have to have certification. And if basically the certification he's had is dodgy, he was in no position to teach anyone.
Well, I mean, yes, that would be part of any legal claim, but it will be founded on a contractual claim with the university. And it would be interesting to see, because there's an article in Unheard. I've kept up with some of it. There's an article in Unheard today written by someone from Roehampton who had Ardaie as a teacher.
Oh, I heard about this. Yeah.
And it's just, you just sit there and read it. And I'm afraid, and I'm going to steal my partner's comments here. She read it and just went, the way he's moved from university to university, in every case, after getting terrible, you know, students finding he's useless and not learning anything and all of the stuff that goes with it, he gets moved from university to university when he becomes a huge hot potato.
That's known as the Catholic Church approach.
Yes, well, that's exactly it. That's exactly what my partner said. You took the words right out of my mouth.
I was thinking exactly.
You know,
the same
it thing. Is. It's let's move the dodgy kiddy fiddling priest along to the next parish. That's exactly what it is. And the thing is, I have now. I'm not going to name.
Although you're not accusing him of having interfered with children, are you, Helen?
No. I'm just accusing him of being a crap teacher.
I thought that was important to clarify.
Oh, yes. Universities realise he's a crap teacher, like disastrously crap, the kind of thing that really, really finishes up in newspapers and so on and so forth, and then just gets moved along to another university. And the thing is, I have encountered this story of disastrously bad academics for various reasons, not always teaching, sometimes there are other reasons, being moved on. in the same way, and nobody gets to find out about it.
Moved on. I thought, who's backing this person that he's moved on? Often when you apply for an academic job,
I am getting the echo now.
You're hearing the echo.
I am. My voice is echoing.
Well, it's fine. Nobody else is hearing the echo.
I am.
Are you?
Oh, you are.
I'm hearing it from Helen.
Oh, bloody hell.
And I came from Liverpool, where someone mentioned in the comments the local newspapers call the Echo, and the street sellers used to shout out, Echo! Echo! So I'm being triggered from past memories. And then I mentioned the Catholic Church, I could bow out at the interview soon.
All right, okay. Hopefully it's all right. Lipton just seems to have given... Okay, good.
I think it's still there.
Could you try turning your sound down a little bit, Helen? It might be picking up on feedback.
How do I do that?
That's better.
Settings.
Ed, we can't hear you now. Although that's the way I do prefer it.
All right. How does that sound?
No echo, but then we can't hear Ed, which, like I say, is a blessing. I think we should introduce this every week.
Okay, how does that sound?
Ed's never spoken more since. He's severely on the spectrum, Helen, so I fully expect him to have a meltdown and start smashing things very soon. We can't hear you, Ed.
I can't hear you, Ed. You're mute. You're muted. Well, this is quite amusing.
It is. It's one of the funnier episodes.
I hope your listeners don't mind. Oh, no, now my echo's back.
Right, can you hear me now?
Yes, unfortunately.
I don't want to hear anything about echoes, otherwise you'll be banned from the show. It's really... Right, good. Now, where were we? The implication is that there's some movement behind him, because normally it's very difficult to get an academic job. There's far too many doctorates given out. And this is a person that has a meager publication record. He didn't even publish any articles in academic journals while he was a PhD student. He got his PhD in 2015, didn't even publish. What's Lipton doing?
Wasn't his publication record? I know it's a low bar, but didn't he beat the Harvard University president in terms of sheer publications?
Yeah,
admittedly, most of them were made up, but even her made up publications weren't that many. So she was even bad at making up publications.
Yeah, she was bad at stealing other people's ideas. How that happened, I don't know. At least this guy had some publications. Although I don't know to what extent he was actually involved in writing them. I mean, maybe he...
Has anyone actually spoken to the woman from Brunel University with the Polish name Zwodziak?
Well, I would assume that they've tried to get in touch with her.
And she's saying, no, which is fine. I mean, I've been the person, I write a bit about this in my Substack. I've been the person who has just said, no, I'm not going to talk to the press. So if she wants to not talk to them, that's completely fine.
Lipton, I'm putting you in with your mic off. Okay. I think it must be, because that's one of the first things you'd probably do is ask her opinion and get her view on it. And it's not just her. There's another. It's interesting the people he's selected as well. Coffin has argued that it was quite. It's not like he's plagiarised someone important, someone that's really, really big in academia that you'd notice. He's gone and found at that time a 6-year-old doctoral thesis at a relatively obscure university, and he's obviously unfortunately they're all online these days, and so that makes it so much easier to do. Than had he had to go to the library and find a doctoral thesis and plagiarise it. So
I didn't see the interview where Nathan made that point, but I have seen a few of my, because I have some involvement in the gender critical group, I did notice a few of the feminists making the point that, he likes going after junior women, doesn't he? People without any institutional power, as you were saying.
Well, I suppose she's a reader. She's not a junior. She's a middle-ranking academic.
But that was a long time ago when he took her her thesis. Oh, you're right. That's a good point.
Yeah, she wasn't a really good point. Of course, that's a very good point. Yes, yes, exactly. So she was a junior academic or whatever then when he did it, presumably. And then he's just cut and pasted it. And there's no excuse, oh, I'm autistic, so I cut and paste. The spelling, the mistakes, grammatical mistakes and things were left in. So it's quite cunning. And you just think to yourself, well, how did he... did they read it? That's another thing that concerns me.
Have any of you listened, and it's worth doing this because it's all over the internet, there is quite a good clip, about 3 or 4 minutes long, of Jason Arday twisting James O'Brien, the journalist, right around his little finger like
that's not exactly difficult.
No, I know, but the thing is, it's not just, this is someone, you listen to the, get it off the internet, it's not hard to find, it's all over Twitter X and whatnot. Jason Arday has charisma. This extraordinary snow job that he does on James O'Brien. Okay, James O'Brien is easy to snow, we've seen that. But this is just extraordinary. It is like the best estate agent who manages to sell you a dog box that you did not want. It is the Amway salesman who you would normally shoot off of your property. Somehow he has managed to just, he's just so smooth.
Well, Helen, you say that, but I watched the Krishan Guru Murphy interview and it was just embarrassing. He basically said, what would you like to do if you could have had some control over the world? And he did some pastiche of, I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. We could all sing Kumbaya. And it was just embarrassingly bland and generic. And Krishan and Guru Murphy didn't pull him up on it.
You could see the look on his face, though. Krishan Guru Murphy, I could see he looked confused. He's like, hang on.
Well, that's his normal face. I dispute that. That's any different.
Well, okay, perhaps you're right. But he did look to me to be particularly confused, as though, hang on, this guy's professor of sociology or whatever at Cambridge, and he's saying such a vacuous thing.
He's worked with Cathy Newman, so he's got a very high tolerance for banal, incoherent generalities.
What Arday does to James O'Brien is what Australians call blowing smoke up the other person's ass. It's an extraordinary exercise in flattery, but it's very cleverly done.
Lipton, I'm bringing you in now. Okay, yes?
Yeah.
The echo's back.
I'm speaking without an echo. I'm not hearing myself being echoed.
No, so, Lipton, I'm defending you. It's not you, it's Helen. I think we should all pick on Helen.
No, it's not Helen at all. That's one of the reasons why I am so upset, because of the echo, I can't get to speak enough to compliment Helen, so I'm really upset.
Well, don't let us interrupt you, Lipton, go on.
It's okay, Lipton, say things, go.
Yeah, so let me continue the point. Education is one of those subjects where the research has not only a low replicability rate, but apparently the lowest rate of replicability. Education as a research field, and then we all know that sociology is low quality. So Jason Arday, he was in the right profession. Unfortunately, I read the report last night pertaining to a student, and I said to myself, what type of supervision did those students require? Because if you are being taught by Jason Arday, more than likely you are specializing in a low G-loaded subject. So it's easy. So what type of supervision did they really require? And if they did poorly as a result of his instructions, then probably those students should never have been at Cambridge in the first place. I'm not defending the incompetence of Jason, but if you can't pass a course that he's teaching, why are you at Cambridge?
Yes, this is an interesting point. I mean, the nearest thing I can think of in terms of a course that I've sat, which is just meaningless ideological bollocks, is when I was an undergraduate, and there was this course called, sometimes it would be called contemporary theology or practical theology. And it was just meaningless nonsense. I was once at a conference, and this guy's conference presentation was essentially, should Christians read Harry Potter? Well, so what? Why is that worthy of research? Who cares? It would be that kind of level of course, wouldn't it? It would be particularly what his own course, his own stuff has been, which is just autoethnography. So it's him writing about his feelings about being a black man that's doing a PhD.
Abinad, could I push back slightly on this in the sense that there's a new book out about Stanford University. I have no links with it. I just wanted to give it a plug. There's a review in Compact Magazine in the States, and it's called How to Rule the World, an Education in Power at Stanford University by a guy called Theo Baker. And it's a fascinating review because he basically points to all the Stanford as a disproportionately science STEM-based university and the number of scandals and the lack of replicability of various scientists. And he gives a loads of stats about how many cancer studies have been found to be bogus. So this plagiarism, lack of reproducibility of results, all of these issues are absolutely rife throughout the whole. I think it's a misnomer to think that, of course, there are ridiculously wishy-washy subjects, but the most scientific subjects are also suffering from different types of corruption.
Well, the problem with peer review is that it depends on the good opinions of your peers, which means you have to be liked. This sets up an extraordinary regime of perverse incentives. You know, nothing gets reality tested if you do that.
But Helen, my point is, even in subjects where reality testing is the sine qua non, it's still happening.
Because the problem is actually peer review. I don't actually think it works. And to the extent that it did work historically, I think you're just finding your system depended on a mixture of very clever people with great integrity, that does matter, personal character matters, placed under extraordinary pressure to get things right in countries that were at war with each other.
Yeah, Helen, you're not wrong about peer review, but it's not the only factor. So, for example...
I am not a monocausal...
Wait a second. If people have manipulated the results, you can only take the results as presented if you're peer reviewing in good faith.
That's a second issue. So the first thing is, I think Helen is right, that the peer review is... certainly in science, peer review is a corrupt system. You know perfectly well that you've got to play the game. You're going to get your peer reviewer, but you might get a queer reviewer, and they'll be ideologically motivated. And you've got to sort of calm down what you've said, which is a fact, because there might be a queer reviewer. And so there's that, and then you know when you're reading an academic paper, he doesn't want to write that paragraph. He's been made to put that in by a peer reviewer. We know the game. But the other problem is that there's such pressure to publish. Which means that what...
Boys, that's been around for a while. I can remember reading articles about that when I was, in high school. Publish or perish, they used to call it. And I'm quite old now, so...
Yeah, my microphone has turned up as high as it can go, so there's no point asking me to turn my microphone up, so don't do it again.
You could speak louder, Ed.
Shut up, okay? It is as loud as it goes. It doesn't go louder than this, otherwise I have to fiddle around with a thing on the back of it called the pattern.
Ed, you have a human voice. You could raise that. You could shout for the rest of the programme.
No, I'm not doing it. I'm not going to give these people the satisfaction, okay? I'm not having it. I could turn up the gain if you want me to turn up the gain, but otherwise the next person that asks me to turn the volume up will be banned. So I'm gonna go full Paul Taylor on this, okay? If you're in the chat and you moan about an echo or the volume, I will ban you. And I don't know how to unban you. That's the worst thing. I don't actually know.
Lipton
how to do
wants
it.
To say something.
Lipton, say something. Turn on your own mic.
Theo Baker, Paul, I have been following him for some time. A few days ago, he was being interviewed on YouTube and I listened to the interview, and then he did a monologue and I also listened to the monologue. I know people who went to Stanford. At Stanford, some of the smartest students are encouraged to deceive the system by using fraudulent strategies. And that's what Theo Baker said in his interview. So there's this class called How to Rule the World with 12 selected students, and they are taught how to extract leverage from other people. So the comparison between natural plagiarism and the replicability crisis at Stanford might not be so logical, because many of the people at Stanford were engaging in these deceptive strategies they're doing it to exploit the system. They want status and money. They're motivated by power. So they know that what they're doing is wrong. But Stanford is connected to the industrial sector. So their research has to reflect the commercial values of the industrial sector. That's basically the argument of Theo Baker. So these people who are not replicating their studies at Stanford, they're not stupid. They're not naive. Many of them do know exactly what they're doing. But it's done to get money and power. That's why the book is titled How to Rule the World. Many of the students who attend Stanford only want to make money. They either want to transition into foreign policy or work at Silicon Valley. But that's the goal for them, to make money.
Yeah, but Lipton, I'm not talking about the intentions as to why people cheat. I'm pointing out in both instances there are provable examples of cheating. You're discussing the motivations for cheating.
Yes.
Two separate issues.
Yes.
But I think the issue is you've just got widespread bending of the system.
Yes.
Here we go.
Dabonny Warrior, I'm slightly confused. Are they complaining?
I don't know why. It's not a problem any other week. I don't know why it's a problem this week. It's incomprehensible.
Yeah, but it's an odd comment to make, because we've got all the bases covered. Every single thing that could go wrong has gone wrong.
Right, so therefore you don't need to comment on it again, do you? There's an echo. Either listen to the echo and cope with the echo, or go away. It's quite simple. It's like, I don't want you to watch if there's a problem with the, for you. This is the sound. I've had this since 2019. Every so often, for some reason, there's some sound problem. What is the point? What is the point of writing in the chat, which I can see, cope and see, ha ha ha. So I was like, right, ban them. A mega ban is coming, okay? Do not comment on the cocking sound. I've been saying this for 7 years.
Do you see the irony, though, that I ban people at the drop of a hat, but I haven't banned anyone this week because I'm enjoying it too much.
That's fair enough. Echo chamber, that's the worst cliche that these idiots keep writing. Someone wrote that about 20 minutes ago, and some spastic has now written an echo chamber.
I won't lie, Ed. I don't think I like your followers. No, I don't like them. No, I don't think Ed's followers are pretty smart.
Right, look, where were we? We've gone off. Yes, I was going to say about the problem with overpublication. So with needing to publish. So when Helen was saying the thing about the publish or perish. So almost 30 years ago, when I was at university, there was a lecturer in the philosophy department called Mr. Martin Hughes. That was his name, Mr. Martin Hughes. And he, as far as I remember, I checked, he had about three publications, three journal articles, and no doctorate. But he'd obviously signed his contract back in whenever it was, I don't know, like the 60s. And you only had to have a master's degree to work at university in those days. And it was a job for life. And so that was it. And he was a very good lecturer, to be fair. He was actually a very good, like, inspiring, interesting lecturer. But he had three article publications and no book and no doctorate. And that was fine. And there wasn't the pressure for him to publish. He published something if he thought he had something interesting to say. And
I'm not completely persuaded of this argument that you should be publishing a whole lot of new research. One of the things I say in the Substack piece is I think that quite a lot of disciplines are basically a waste of everybody's time and shouldn't be at a university. And what you need universities for is a relatively small but important proportion of the population where you're not able to teach yourself how to do it, to be a lawyer, to be a doctor, to be an engineer, to be a pharmacist, to be an accountant. You can't teach yourself. You have to be taught, whether it's at a university or elsewhere. And I basically see, because universities are just burning up their credibility, but you still need someone to train the great professions. And I don't care if the universities enormously shrink and just only train the professions and there's no more publication and research. I just don't care. Just train. Just train the people you need to train and then fuck off.
We've worked out the problem, Helen. So, yes, I agree with you completely. It's absurd. I mean, there was someone that was saying the other day that we should get to a point where maybe people that get A's and B's at A-level, they should go to university. But that's it. If you can't get a B at A-level these days, you really shouldn't be going. We've worked out what's happened, Helen. You have an echo whenever Lipton's microphone is on.
Oh, good grief.
And only.
Oh, no, well, his microphone is off and I just got a little echo then.
Yep.
Right, so you
get, Helen, have you got another browser open apart from the one you're using now?
Not at all.
If we all want to look on the bright side, apparently our viewing numbers in Switzerland have gone through the roof.
Lipton, you've turned your mic on and Helen's echoing again, because you've turned your mic on. I did switch it off. If you could switch, there you go.
There you go. So,
Helen echoes.
Test.
Yeah, it's fine.
No, that's a... I can hear a bit of an echo. I'm willing to put up with it, but I don't want to inflict it on other people. That's the thing.
None of us can hear it. None of us can hear any echo. We can only hear an echo when Lipton's microphone is switched on.
Okay.
It's just sheer madness. And then there's some bitch that's moaning about pissing or whatever. Like, just to annoy me. Just to annoy me. The only possible reason is to annoy me. But apparently some bastard is writing echo in capital letters, knowing how much it will provoke me, like knowing that we're trying to have a serious discussion of one of the biggest things that's happened in academia in years and years and years and years, and it's just these childish people
We were discussing reproducibility problems and we've nailed it. All we're doing is reproducing ourselves endlessly. So we're ahead of the curve.
As infinitum, as it were. Right, we're about halfway through, so those of you that knew...
Lipton's turned all German. What's up, Lipton?
Lipton, I can't...
I want to speak, no.
Yeah, okay, but...
This is an issue that people are not discussing enough. Scholarship. David Enigi, well, this is basically a mini lecture. So David Enigi founded the journal History in Africa. There's also the Journal of African Studies, African Studies Review. These journals produce superb research sometimes, but back in the day, in the 70s, the 80s, that was the golden age, an African renaissance for history. Sometimes I'm online reading the Journal of African History, and the literature is a bit contemporary. People want to talk about gender in African 1950s, the politics of the decolonization movement. Enough of the articles do not cover, let's say, diplomatic history in 19th century Nigeria. It's titled the Journal of African History. So my point in a nutshell is that much of Black history is simply black people talking about themselves, and Black scholarship is a bit too narrow. There's this Black philosopher of biology who is really interesting. He doesn't get enough attention, but he's interesting. But Jason Arday, like Black women, he writes about Black issues. They're always talking about themselves, and I wonder why. Why can't they use the new data to talk about the iron industry in Zimbabwe during the pre-colonial era? Well, somebody has done that, but not enough people are writing along that line of literature. They're always talking about their experience as a Black person. Why is that so interesting? I don't think it is.
Autoethnography, I've always thought, is memoir. People who aren't good enough to write.
Turn your mic off!
Memoir. I'll repeat that. Autoethnography is a type of memoir. It's meant to be a sort of an academic form of memoirism. And the thing is, memoir writing is notoriously unreliable, even when good writers do it. And famously, there's a famous quip that I think is attributed often to Pétain, which is, I'm not going to write a memoir because people who do write them are trying to make an excuse for themselves.
Yes, this is true. I don't know if people can hear me. I've made some technical changes. Is there an echo now?
Not for me, there is. It is. Now it's back.
Oh, for Christ's sake. Yeah, that's not Lipton this time. All right, I'll take these out then and plug the phones in. Right. Okay, hello? Hello. Brilliant. I can't hear an echo now, so I expect.
Can't you?
No, I can't. No.
Oh dear.
Well, he's being very badly behaved, Helen. He does this sometimes, and it's meant to be.
Sorry, Ed, because we've set such a serious technical standard. I thought I'd go along with the flow. God.
It's always been technically fine. It's something to do with someone. It's either Lipton or Helen. We can't be sure which at the moment, but we think it's probably it's Helen's mic. Is her PC? Someone's saying, "Yeah, I love the way that people that aren't in the same room as Helen, or Lipton, or me, try and diagnose what's going on when there's it's obviously."
Well, you can ignore them. They're dead weight.
Pure speculation. Okay, we're about halfway through, so Lipton, turn your mic off. Hello, and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are, of course, an online public house. It's on Mondays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York. We discuss base science and psychology and stuff that's in the news and whatever that's increasingly expunged from our woke joke universities. And if you're new, would you please subscribe? Would you subscribe on YouTube and leave a like and hit the bell button and leave a comment and all that kind of stuff? And would you subscribe on my Substack? That's jollyheretic.com, where I put all the most based research I don't put on YouTube, in-person interviews, vlogs, films I make. I'm going to do about Slough quite soon. And if you like what I do, you can support for the cost of a pint of beer a month. Next to me, we have Dr. Paul Taylor. And he has his own YouTube channel as well. And this is called Readers of the Lost Art. What are you working on at the moment, Paul?
I just did a video. Have you seen the Chinese lady Zong Shu? Is her alias as a podcaster. She interviewed Christopher Nolan and basically made him look very foolish. And talking about academic standards, she's a Chinese PhD student studying in America. And she just asked some good academic questions. And he was just blethering. It's a 17-minute interview. I recommend people have a look at it. So I've done some work on that, showing that Christopher Nolan hasn't got the slightest clue. He keeps talking about Greek philosophy and theology, and he hasn't got a clue. And she really brought this out. It was a brilliant interview.
Okay, so one of the few examples of a genuinely good Chinese person going to a Western university. Yeah. We don't get that very often. When I was a postgrad at Aberdeen University, there were a load of Chinese people, and they could barely speak English, but they'd get brilliant marks. And I could never understand how until I discovered the concept of an essay mill and realised that may well have been what they were
this
using.
This is a more modern thing of the whole essay mill. I changed my... AirPods and it's not worked. It's still echoing. I might have to go. I think this is just ruining it for other people.
It's only echoing for you. Lipton, because Lipton's put the microphone on again, so that's why there's now an echo. But it's something to do with Lipton, and we can't understand what. But you're fine at the moment. Why don't you just take the earpods out completely and use speakers?
I suspect it'll probably make it even worse.
Well,
but the thing is, if nobody else can hear it and only I can hear it, I'll just have to put up with it.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine at the moment, as long as Lipton doesn't put his microphone on. It's extraordinary, this. There must be some technicality we haven't thought of.
Have you opened and closed the windows?
Well, I can take Helen out and put her back in and see what happens then. This is highly technical stuff here. So if I remove Helen... Right. Is there an echo? No. Paul, say something.
Hello.
Right. Lipton, say something. Quickly.
Hey.
Yeah, that's the echo. Whatever the echo is, that's the echo. So turn the mic off. Sorry. It's your end. I can hear an echo now. Please turn the mic off. So... Okay, so at the moment we think it's something to do with Lipton, Helen. So there you are. Anyway, we have a resident poet here at the Jolly Heretic Public House, Mr. Quinn, and he has the following poem in light of tonight's topic of discussion, which I have to go and find. Hang on a minute. It says, Oxbridge, a key institution, their standards were free from dilution. The once dreaming spires are now full of liars. They call the call must now be restitution. Thank you very much, Mr. Quinn. And if cheers, Mr. Quinn. And if you like Mr. Quinn's poetry, then you can purchase his book of jolly heretic poetry. And this is available on the old Amazon. So please go over there and buy that. Thank you, Mr. Quinn. And cheers to wherever you are. Right. We have a question from Maestro Mark. Thank you, sir. And he says, have you noticed anti-racism coming under more mainstream scrutiny as an ideology? I've heard some very good critiques of it. Or I'll start with Paul. Paul, have you noticed anti-racism coming under more scrutiny as an ideology, and have you heard some good critiques of it?
What interested me about the whole RD thing more than anything was the way it's being picked up in the States. I just think watching a lot of non-mainstream but quite high-profile podcasters in the States, they didn't in the past tend to pay a lot of attention to the UK. But increasingly, with the way the police have gone and with this scandal, that's interesting, the way in which the Americans have focused on it. I think things have got so bad in the UK. And I'm a great believer in sometimes things have to get much worse before they can improve. And I think universities need to implode even more so that something can finally be done about it.
Lipton. Tony Michael.
Find it odd that so many people are referring to Nathan Kufnos as a racist. So Jesse Singel did not refer to him as a racist, but he said that there's a perceived correlation between race and IQ. There isn't a perceived correlation, so people are not using the controversy to elevate the race and IQ conversation, and they're calling Nathan Kufnos a racist quite confidently. Somebody said Nathan Kufnos is a racist. Yes, what he's saying is true, but he's a racist. I think that argument is a bit stale.
Fair enough. Okay,
and I interviewed Nathan Kufnos.
You did, we've just published it.
Yes. He came on my show. Yes. Not on Ed's show.
we know. I thought it was best that you go in, to be honest. Helen, what do you think?
I actually think that quite a lot of this has blown the conversation open around a lot of places, and I haven't realised the extent to which it's gone across the pond, but that's fine. I know it's a big news story in Australia, although it's become a news story in Australia in part because of the comments that RDA made about Australian television programmes like Neighbours. Home and Away, and Australians objected to that. I mean, those things are very historically very successful media and entertainment exports from Australia. I think actually the conversation, the race and IQ part is part of it, and not everybody is necessarily disrespecting Nathan Kufnos. Quite a lot of he's been written about quite respectfully as well in the press. But what is being written about respectfully in the press, and it's across the spectrum, this is just the disastrous, ruinous process that led to this man's appointment to this professorial chair. The fact that there are disciplines in universities that are just nonsense, absolute nonsense. You just see people making comments like, I discovered there was a subject in Marxist geography at Oxford. What? You know, this kind of... people have had the opportunity to see this stuff. A lot of people who haven't in the past known that this is the kind of nonsense that people can go to university and finish up ostensibly studying.
Yeah.
On the taxpayer in this country too.
Yes, on the taxpayer, they are studying total nonsense. And surely, there's quantum sociology. Someone's put in the chat exactly. Surely it has to get to a point where you see, consider that being black and writing about being black, and then having a degree in someone that being black and writing about being black is not worth it. It doesn't help you get anywhere. Yes, Lipson.
An issue. I studied at a prominent university in the UK, Glasgow, and when I was a student at Glasgow, I did a course on Scottish history, a course on medieval history. I wanted to do war and the Great Divergence because I'm interested in economic history, but there was an issue getting my visa, so some of the courses that I wanted to do, I did not get to do them. So I was at Glasgow, and the teachers were okay. They had no issues with these teachers. I would write an essay, and it was good, and they would give me like glowing reviews, and I would still get a B or a low value A. It was the same for my thesis. I repeat this story all the time. One lecturer, the outside lecturer, gave me an A. The inside lecturer gave me a B, so they settled on a B1. And I said to myself, all right, I did not expect special treatment, but I am black. Why didn't people fawn over me, Ellen? I just couldn't understand why.
Well, this is the I don't know how many of you have read Douglas Murray's article for The Spectator, but there is this expectation, and it is most dramatically, it is more dramatically than in the race issue, divided the broader gay rights movement, where if you are a particular diverse identity minority, you are expected to have a certain package of politics to go with it. And if in some way, and it can be quite subtle, as I understand it from people who've talked to me about this, if in some way you fail to uphold that ideology that is expected of you if you're black or a lesbian or a feminist or whatever, then you don't get the benefit of equality, diversity and inclusion. It doesn't. It's not conferred on you. And a number of ethnic minority people, there was a chap in Australia who I know is a legal academic, and lawyers tend to be quite clever, and he used to be a partner at a law firm in Hong Kong, Kevin Yam, and he made the point. He said, and oh yes, and someone like me, because I've made these observations, I put a long tweet out that went viral about Jason Arday and the problems with research dud courses across universities. And he says, and oh yes, I'll just be a colonial white adjacent oaf for saying this. That's what happens. Now, okay, he's East Asian, his background is Chinese. But they'll do it to them as well. Oh, no, you don't have the right set of politics to go with your colour or sex or sexual orientation. And where it's really shown up for gay rights is, of course, is the transgender issue. You know, this is incredible, what Dennis Nell Kavanagh calls this incredible forced teaming of gays, lesbians and bisexuals with the alphabet people. It's the same thing. And if you don't say the right thing, then I have seen, you know, prominent lesbian feminists like Julie Bindle called Nazis.
Yeah, yeah, she was, and she had her book unpublished as well, didn't she?
This is extraordinary. You have to have the right views, or otherwise your diversity doesn't count.
Although, could I just point out, Suzanne Moore and Julie Bindle used to be quite, let's say, abrasively radical writing in The Guardian, and the minute they get cancelled, they skulk off to right-wing publications.
I know, I'm quite happy to say, I mean, I'm one of the sort of the right-wing homosexuals club here. I'm quite happy to say there are quite serious problems with feminism as a historical and intellectual movement as it emerged post about 1965. It did have nastily authoritarian streaks, and it did minimise the significant gaps, physical particularly, between men and women, and you try to, and all the, I can remember, I'm old enough to remember all the stupid crap over gender-neutral language in the 80s and so on and so forth. And I guess it's set itself up for a fall. Absolutely it has. You know, and all of these people suddenly realise the mess that they're in, and not just them. I mean, for a long time, Graham Mahan had on his Twitter account, I apologise for all the opinions I had before 2018, or words to that effect. Because he used to be a right-on lefty as well. Look what he did to Count Dankula, the Scottish comedian. And then he changed and he apologised to Marcus Meakin over that incident. I mean, this is a problem. It's the leopards eating people's faces party joke. You know, all these people thought that they could happily vote for the leopards eating people's faces party, political party, and then the leopards came and ate their faces and they're in trouble.
Yeah, he really shouldn't have been so dogmatic in the first place in the 1990s. I mean, he should. It's Graham Linehan, I mean. I mean, I've interviewed Graham on the channel, and I like him, and he's been.
Oh no, and his book is excellent, and he is completely frank. Tough Crowd is a terrific book, and he acknowledges exactly his bad behaviour, and he apologises fulsomely in print in a best-selling book that sold 100,000 copies to Marcus Meakin, and rightly so, though. I mean, he participated in a public cancellation. And the thing is, the modern ones tend to work. I mean, Marcus was fined, he was dragged to court and all of this kind of thing. It was pretty ugly. The only reason the attempted cancellation of me in 1995 didn't work is because it was before social media. But it was still very unpleasant.
What were
the
inside. You were writing under a Ukrainian name?
Over this, I was accused of anti-Semitism, basically. It was Jewish lobby with me. This was, if you go back to the 90s, it was Jews that did it. I mean, I've had this conversation with Nathan Kofness when he came on my Substack. You know, Jews used to do it. And there's been some very nasty litigation in Australia, which I've written about for Quillette, where in the lead up to Bondi, and so before Bondi had happened, so it was all still peaceful, there hadn't been any terrorism at this point, you just had mutual doxing and cancellation and complaints activism between pro-Palestinians and pro-Israel people. And it finished up being litigated, some of it did, because everybody has decided that it's not just Jews who get to fight their battles that way, everybody does. Let's all go and get the person we don't like and let's get him sacked. It's become, you know, a universal solvent for civil society. Instead of arguing and debating with each other, it's, no, I'm not going to listen to you, I'm going to get you sacked.
Yeah, and feel a sense of self-righteous...
Oh, absolutely.
...brilliance in the process. I'm a wonderful moral person. I've got an okay now. Oh, Lipton's... that's why Lipton's got one.
The good thing about cancellation is that I have written for controversial publications, so whenever people opt to criticize me, I just say to them, look, when blacks were enslaved, they were not allowed to have a voice, so me being controversial is literally reparations, and if you criticize me, you are racist. So exactly.
Oh, that's glorious.
Yes.
I think that's a
glorious.
Yeah, that's reparations. Free speech is reparations for black people.
That's superb. Yeah. Can you put your microphone off, Lipton, because I've got an echo. Blacks weren't allowed to be racist under slavery. Although, no, thinking about it,
they weren't allowed to be anything. That's kind of the point of slavery. I always analogize it with, and obviously this is the ancient world. I've written two novels partially with a Roman setting. And one of the things you learn, Roman slavery was not race-based. That's not the way the ancient world worked. But the view of slaves as not having their own minds, unless they were told to have their own minds by the person who owned them, is just pervasive through their law and their culture. I mean, the expression that is used is an instrumentum vocale, the tool that speaks.
Yeah.
In Latin.
When there are cases of Roman slaves or which am I thinking of? Greek slavers that wrote about things, that actually had opinions?
Yes. I mean, probably the really famous one is Epictetus. He was owned by Musonius Rufus, who was a posh Roman lawyer who dabbled in philosophy. And we've got some of Musonius Rufus's writing, and it's very good. He was a wonderful stylist in Latin. But Epictetus was a Greek slave, and he was disabled. And he was owned by Musonius Rufus, and Musonius Rufus, Stoicism is unusual. It's a historically unusual, psychologically unusual expression of morality. And it was the first version, example that the world had ever seen of forms of abolitionism. Stoics did unusual things morally. They would do things like... The reason in Roman law there was the development of what we would consider to be a mutual structure, something like John Lewis, was because it was considered non-new and socially unacceptable for a Roman citizen of either sex to work for a wage, because slaves worked for a wage, and the only exception to this were soldiers And soldiers were paid a salary, salarium, which is honourable, whereas slaves were paid a peculium, and the root in Latin is the same, but for pecuniary interest and peculation and things that we consider somewhat dodgy. And so the reason that Stoics developed a mutual structure was to make it socially acceptable. This is an important part of Roman law, to make it socially acceptable for Romans citizens to work for a wage. And so Stoics were historically unusual people who had quite unusual ideas. So Epictetus is your famous example of the slave who wrote. And wrote beautifully and very knowledgeably, and of course Stoicism is the basis of cognitive behavioural therapy, which is the only bit of psychology that counselling, clinical psychology, that really works.
Yes, so good. So some of them could, and Lipton deserves. Yes, Lipton.
In a complementary argument, during slavery, both in the American South and in the West Indies, there were entrepreneurial slaves. Slaves were stratified based on their position. So skilled slaves, entrepreneurial slave, the house slave. Some slaves, because of their expertise, they were sometimes paid, especially in the American South. Obviously, slavery impeded human capital formation, but that argument is not applicable in every context. There are some researchers, so Klaus Runbach has a paper on slavery and human capital, especially numeracy. There are also papers on slave literacy in Brazil. And I'm saying this against the backdrop of the argument that blacks have done poorly due to slavery, because based on my reading of slavery, yes, it was a disadvantage, but slavery did provide opportunities. And I've read many studies on slavery and colonialism, and the slavery argument is just an exaggeration. Within a generation or two, the black slaves who were phenotypically black, their descendants were able to achieve parity with mulattoes who had more privilege. So people like Robert Margo and others that have said, after abolition, obviously blacks were not millionaires on average, they weren't super esteemed. But for people who were in slavery for so long, they did relatively well. So I don't buy the slavery argument for reparations.
Of course, and in antiquity, I probably should point out, in classical antiquity, the Romans are the best evidenced, because their slavery was not based on race, and it was not based on the idea that slaves were inherently inferior or anything like that. I mean, within a generation, the only clue that you get that someone was a slave in the Roman world after a manumission of an ancestor is they might have a surname like Felix or Felicia, and it just means lucky or happy in Latin. If you've been to the house of Julia Felix in Pompeii, a beautiful home, you can see her home, it's one of the lovely ones you could all walk through, and all her, and she's obviously a posh lady and a power in the town and all of those things, and there's this lovely Gracian home, gracious home with the columns and so on and so forth, and all that says is that she had an ancestor a couple of generations earlier who was a freed slave and took the surname Felix, because it was, you know, lucky, hopeful, you know.
Didn't know that. Yes, Lipton.
Slaves, so African slavery did function on a spectrum. So in places like Asante, slaves were sacrificed. Some slaves were badly treated. In West Africa, they were beaten. But slaves were also incorporated within the broader family kin. But where slavery was a major social disadvantage was really in West Africa, because long after abolition, descendants of enslaved people still encounter discrimination, and they do today even in the Igbo parts of Nigeria, Usu slaves. So if you are a descendant of a shrine slave, you still encounter discrimination. But those descendants, surprisingly, relative to other Nigerians, are successful. But they do encounter discrimination. Even today, people oppose the marriages of Usu slaves to non-Usus, well, the descendants.
How are they identified? Is it off the surname?
No, I don't know the exact mechanism of identification, but the Usu slaves were shrine slaves, so I guess it's based on their family lineage.
Right, and people would know it in more strongly
Exactly. So even today in Nigeria, as recently as the 2020s, today in Nigeria, Usu descendants still experience discrimination. There's a stigma attached to them, even when they are ice
skaters. It's like the Kago in France. That's extraordinary. Nobody knows why the Cago, C-A-G-O-T, were discriminated against in France. It's just one of the enduring mysteries about why this minority is until relatively recently, within the last sort of 30 or 40 years before it finally disappeared, is the Cago. And they were exactly what Lipchit is describing, which is this just seen as this group that was lesser, and persistent discrimination for no apparent reason. And it was forgotten. The reason for the discrimination has been forgotten.
Same with the Barakumin in Japan.
Yes, that's another one.
People aren't quite sure whether it's the job that they did or whether they were pushed into that.
Same story with the Kago. They don't know whether it was the job they did or whether they had a funny version of a local religion. Or there are all sorts of theories that nobody can prove.
Yeah, and we don't know. And then there's obviously we know with the caste system in India, they have a caste system in amongst the Igbo, don't they? And they have these high caste Igbo that are blacksmiths or something. I know that, and they're discriminated against. There's these various caste systems. In Somalia, they have the blacksmith caste, and the blacksmith caste are responsible for circumcisions.
What, with like an anvil and a big bloody
knife? I mean, yes, yeah, that sort of just brings some really truly appalling imagery to mind, I have to say.
Yeah, the blacksmith will come round and circumcise your daughter. And this is how it's done. I don't know if he does it like with an anvil or I don't know the details. But I read about it in Ian Hersey Ali's autobiography.
I mean, well, this is not a book of mine, but I bought it and I've read bits of it. I mean, the dysfunctional things that exist in various societies around the world are just absolutely extraordinary. And he spares no one. This has got the original Duddy's Branch story, which is in rural Kentucky, you know, where they're all marrying each other. And it's just...
Robert was a really important anthropologist. He wrote a book on Asante.
On the Ghanaian civilization.
Yes, he's a really important anthropologist. And he also has a book on blacks in America and soldiers and malaria. Smart guy.
So what are some of the examples of some of the sickest things in that book, Sick Societies, Helen?
Oh, well, he does the female genital mutilation thing. And the way he makes the point is, because people say, well, it's designed to facilitate, you know, female chastity. And that's important in Islam. And he just makes the point, well, most of the world's Muslims don't do it. And they still think female chastity is very important. And they uphold it and they preserve it in their society. Why is this particular society bent out of shape and doing this? And all these other societies that are superficially very similar and have the same religion, they don't do it. That's the way he does that argument. Duddy's Branch in Kentucky is really quite interesting. It's an Appalachia, Scots-Irish situation where basically it's very difficult to get to, or it was, this was all, the research was all done in the 60s. It's very difficult to get to, very few people work, and there is some electricity, but it's the kind of electricity that will run a television and not a fridge. And basically, very few people can read and write. Very few people go to school or leave the community in any way. And nobody works unless they leave. And yet they have figured out, despite this, how to work the 1960s version of the US welfare system, which means everybody sits at home watching televisions, but they don't have fridges, and they don't have proper toilets. It's just group laziness in this area, utterly dysfunctional. And they don't keep records, and including the things that you associate with traditionally tribal cultures of remembering who is related to whom, so you don't I'll use the Aboriginal word from Australia, so that you don't marry into the wrong skin group and finish up marrying your uncle or your cousin or something like that. They don't have that. So there's extraordinary levels of inbreeding. It is just, it is worth reading the book. And the book that he cites, which I went and read some extracts from, was done by an anthropologist back in the 60s. Who went to this area, and there's an aerial photograph and stuff like that, and it is just, it just shows you how society can become utterly dysfunctional and go right down the drain, and in every possible way.
Yes, Lipson.
Len just made an important point. We take literacy for granted. A literate culture is an abstract culture, and as Paul has been telling us for some time now, we're becoming an increasingly semi-literate society. So what does that really pretend for the future? It's an indication that in the future we're going to be less able to do philosophically, and by extension we're going to become less scientific, because we're not evolving to become a literary culture, or Ed knows this, but even our vocabulary is declining. A literary culture is an...
Well, I have to admit, I've written three novels, and they've been pretty successful, and people... I've won my country's major national literary award, the Miles Franklin, which is the Aussie equivalent of the Pulitzer Prize. And I was thinking, sort of last year, I had a long and serious chat to my partner about writing a fourth novel. But novels take up a lot of time to do them properly. I have a good idea, that kind of thing. And it would necessitate me giving up lucrative legal consulting and the legal writing that I do for magazines like Law and Liberty. And it just became increasingly clear that people are not reading novels anymore. The novel is dying. That James Marriott chap who writes for The Times can seem a bit apocalyptic about this sometimes, but he basically is making the same argument that Lipton is making. And he's written a book about it, which I haven't read, but I've read a lot of his columns, which is probably what fed into the book. But we are becoming a non-literate society, or a society that has significant commingling of what people look like when a society looks like when most people can't read and write, and there might be a few people who can. And we've all seen this in developing countries. If you're old enough, there's the person who sits outside the post office who's the scribe, and so a letter gets sent, but it's effectively dictated. Now, this is sort of a world that we've forgotten. Yeah, and it's even fading in developing countries now, but it used to be very widespread. When I was living in Syria, I can remember the scribes sitting outside the post office who would write letters for people. But Marriott's argument is the same as Lipton's. Our society is really changing.
And that's why so many of our podcasters these days are untutored. You know, the public intellectual was once a respected person, but today... How do you become a public intellectual? You become a public intellectual by working as an entertainer and then transitioning into the podcast space. That's why most of our podcasters these days are basically idiots.
Exceptions being on this channel.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm serious.
Nobody accepted.
Public intellectuals
apart
are
from Ed, I mean, the rest of us are kind of amateurs. I mean, I'm normally just a lawyer, that kind of thing. Paul is not. Are you a psychiatrist by training background? I'm not
no,
sure.
No, I'm Ed's support worker.
He's is it Lou? Is that the name of the character in what's it in Little Britain?
Something like that.
No, this is true. I mean, I suppose I was going to say a chap I know said that poetry is faster life history strategist than being a novelist, because poems can be written relatively quickly, even if you edit them or whatever.
A lot of modern poetry doesn't have the qualities that used to make poetry much more important than prose. I mean, you can go to societies that had relatively high rates of literacy for pre-industrial society. Roman Italy is a good example. That's why the Romans could feel confident about putting written labels all over everything, all over their cities, on the basis you don't do that unless the population can read. But even in their society, people wanted would go and listen to recitations and or singing of Virgil or Ovid, you know, because their stuff is, and when you know how to read Latin properly, it's wonderful. It's not rhyming because the Latin works differently. Rhyming in the Roman, in Latin, is basically, was associated with writing nursery rhymes and considered very juvenile.
Virgil was on Thunderbirds, wasn't he?
Yeah, it's wonderfully, wonderfully rhythmical. You know, you can tell as soon as you get into reading Virgil, you know, the description of horses racing and that kind of thing, you can hear that someone who had an ear and a nice speaking voice would recite or sing this for other people.
But we don't have the same points of reference so people understand metaphors and, or comparisons either. So, for example, and I really like this programme, by the way. I was watching it over the weekend, this Clarkson's Farm. And he has this guy on it who's not particularly intellectual called Caleb, but who's very good at farming and very...
He's a very good farm manager. Yes, it's all right. My family are farmers. They're big fans of Clarkson's Farm.
He'd never heard of... Clarkson makes these biblical allusions. And this Caleb guy, he's like, he'd never heard of Moses. And that is an increasingly common thing, that the corpus to which you allude of literature and of the Bible, most obviously, as an example of literature, is no one knows. People just don't know it.
Well, what you've got a loss of, there's an American podcaster I quite like called Josh Slocum, and he doesn't just it's called Disaffected, and he doesn't just talk about things like, you know, novels or poetry or that kind of thing. He talks about common culture. You know, one of the things that bound the generation of the 1980s together, which is, you know, I'm a Generation Xer, is we can all remember the TV shows we watched. Yeah, and we can have these common topics of conversation. The bands that we liked, we hadn't gone down all these separate paths. You know, everybody knew who Bowie was, everybody knew who Prince was, everybody knew who the Eurythmics were, or Boy George, you might like them or might not like them or whatever. But the point is, we all had these common reference points, and they've gone the same way as the Bible and Shakespeare.
Exactly. They've just vanished. Top of the Pops every Thursday, Top of the Pops.
Exactly. Yeah, Josh Slocum, he's very good. He talks about this on a couple of his shows.
And
we'd all, there's loss of common culture.
Coronation Street on Mondays and Wednesdays, and EastEnders yes. on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
There was Mrs. Slocum as well.
Doctor Who followed by the goodies.
Doctor Who was 7 o'clock.
I can remember that in Australia.
Lipton, you've got your microphone on, so I can hear better.
Yes, yes. I was just about to say that these days, obviously, there are celebrities. Beyonce, she is important to people in my age group, but I have appreciated that over the past 10 years, many of the new celebrities, they have achieve stratospheric success, but there is a lack of widespread appeal. So Taylor Swift is popular, people like her, but it's not impossible to say, okay, I don't care that much about Taylor Swift. Some of these celebrities, they don't have that appeal beyond being famous. So Swift is famous and people like her because she's famous, but why do they really like her?
22,
don't see the you. Shake it off, shake it off. Sorry, I'm parliamentarian in Australia, actually saying that in the Senate while I was working as a chief of staff in Australia. I've not forgotten it. He got up and sang Shake It Off.
Like ever. That's Taylor Swift. Right, well, time to round up. So I'd like to thank Helen for coming on. I'm very sorry, chaps, that there was all of these technical problems this evening. I don't know what to call with it. I can hear an echo. Can you finish your microphone off so I can end the show? Thank you. So I'm sorry about all these technical things. We will try and sort them out for next week. So thank you very much, and thank you, Helen, for coming on. It was very interesting to talk to you. And so go and buy Helen's novels, and we will see you all next week. And tally ho, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
See you later.
All right, just wait a minute.